Here we are, Mum. A medieval jousting tournament.
Splendid. Wait, what's that smell?
Medieval sanitation, Mum.
Oh, there's so much mud and everyone's filthy.
What exactly were you expecting?
I don't know. I was hoping for something more like Errol Flynn's Adventures of Robin Hood.
Oh, dear.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril.
Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't been prevented from working by the pictures of Idris Elba coming off the set of The Dark Tower. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. Well, we've navigated away past the worst of the slurry and found this wonderful tent in which we can at least keep clean and dry. The tournament is pausing for lunch, so we shouldn't be too disturbed, and perhaps, after we take tea, we'll be able to watch at least one joust before going back to the 21st century.
I'm sorry to disturb you, Mum, but your guest has arrived, a Mr. Jason Arnup.
Splendid! Let's see his calling card. Oh, it's just black.
Yes, Mum. Black writing on a black card. A favourite device of many successful creators.
Well, it looks very stylish. But what does it say?
Jason Arnup, writer. Tries to make you feel afraid in your own home. I think I might like this one.
Send him in, Latimer.
Very good, Mum.
For those of you who don't know, Jason Arnup is an author and scriptwriter with a background in journalism, including being the news editor for Kerrang! Magazine.
Mr. Jason Arnup, Mum.
Hello, Jason. Do come and sit down. How are you?
Ah, Lady Newman, what a pleasure to see you. I'm very well, despite being in medieval times, which seem to be rather unpleasant.
Yes, it's smellier than I thought it would be.
Yes, well, I mean, it's nice to have a reminder that things once were worse than they are now in our present day, isn't it?
I think that is a very, very nice way to look at it, though the five-year-old bit of my brain is very disappointed that it is not like the Errol Flynn Robin Hood film.
No, it doesn't quite measure up, does it?
No. Never mind. Would you care for some tea?
You know, I'd love some. I don't know what you've got, what kind of array you've managed to gather together in medieval England, but I've had my two coffees for the day, and if I have any caffeine, I might start crawling around the ceiling. But if you have any peppermint tea or chamomile, perhaps?
Oh, a herbal tea. That's controversial. I'm sure that I can find something. Yes, okay, yes. We have something in the hamper for emergencies.
Oh, good.
So peppermint, good for digestion.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I hope we're not mistaken for witches brewing herbs together.
No, I really hope not. So yeah. I'll pour. And I was wondering if you'd like to try this medieval delicacy that we found. These are called brindons, and they're little fried thin cakes. And as you can see, there's this pot of kind of fruity spiced syrup in the middle. You take your brindon and you dip it in the syrup.
Ooh.
Do try one. They're very nice.
I'll certainly run this up the flagpole. Let's have a go. This is quite the experience.
It is, isn't it? So there are some good things about
Absolutely.
The time.
This is a very nice tent, if I may say so.
Thank you. It's not mine, but I'm going to thank you anyway. We borrowed it. I don't know who it belongs to. Hopefully they won't mind.
Well, let's see. I took something strange on my way in. Your butler, was it Latimer? He really reminds me of, who's that fellow, the fellow who wrote the Vagrant and the Malice? He's a spitting image of him.
You know, several people have said that. It's, I don't see it myself, but yeah, he does bear a resemblance to Pete. It's true, but they hate each other.
Oh, do they? With a passion?
With a passion. It's true.
Doppelgangers don't tend to get on, do they?
No, they don't. They don't. As all 80s television shows have taught us.
Yeah, it was one thing we learnt from 80s television shows.
No, I hope you don't mind the chickens over there. They won't bother you. You're not allergic to feathers or anything.
No, and I'm a vegetarian, so they'll be in no trouble from me.
Marvellous. Now, in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
Yes, well, I brought along the 1982 UK video release of the film The Evil Dead.
Oh my goodness!
Yes, you didn't expect that, did you?
I did not expect that.
I kind of feel like no polite tea party is complete without a copy of The Evil Dead on video. So I decided to bring this along for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because I've decided quite recently that it's my favourite horror film. And secondly, because I collect videos of this ancient type. And so it kind of covers a few bases, really.
Yes, I'd heard that you collect videos. I find this really interesting because, you know, you have to be dedicated to collecting something that takes up so much space. What is it about collecting videos that's captured your heart?
Well, I mean, yes, it is a wonderful thing to do until you come to move flat.
Yes.
You know, much like collecting vinyl or even magazines. I think magazines are the bane of any flat mover because they're the ones that... They're the things that are surprisingly heavy.
Mm.
With videos, I think it's partly nostalgia because, you know, like a lot of people, I can remember the, amazingly, people will be shocked to discover that I am old enough to remember video shops. And I think part of collecting videos is about retaining that sense of wonder and that sense of awe. When you looked up at those shelves and you saw these large video cases with the extremely lurid artwork.
Yes.
And especially with horror movies, I guess there was a sense of the forbidden a little bit, you know, that, you know, oh, I'll never be allowed to rent out The Evil Dead or The Exorcist or The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And also, those were strange days, the video days, because the whole video nasty thing was a very peculiar time, a terrible time, with films actually being taken from the shelves, banned, police confiscating videos and people being prosecuted for distributing them. It's good to remember that time. What a bizarre period of history when you think it was only the early 80s. It wasn't all that long ago.
No. And you're right about the whole, the nostalgia of the physical experience of choosing entertainment that we just don't have now. And the excitement of like going to the video shop and, you know, obviously with my parents at the time and knowing that you were going to pick something that was your entire evening's entertainment and you'd have to leave the house to go and choose something to do that.
I know.
And it's just so weird.
To think we once had to actually leave the house. That is a peculiar thought, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. And just the sense of, I mean, it's really nice that you've brought this in because it's really nice to hold something physical again. And this is changing so much just within the span of our lifetimes, but I'm very aware that my son is growing up only experiencing digital and sometimes DVD, but with Netflix, it's, you know, even more digital just in his lifetime, and he's not that old. So it's quite an interesting thing that I find myself thinking about the nature of ownership, that you're collecting videos, you have a physical thing that you can hold and you know that you own it. Do you think that there's an element of that in your collecting?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of the artwork on videos, on old school video films. I think artwork and posters in general used to be more fantastic, more great, basically, because they were actual artwork. And these days, so many posters seem to be kind of photo montages. I don't know. There's probably a whole story in itself as to why that happened, that kind of shift.
Money.
I imagine. I guess so, yeah, which is quite weird. But, the physical aspect of videos is a wonderful thing because you can, you know, I'm holding this thing in my hand now and it's quite heavy, quite chunky. It's in an oversized padded box. It's got a sleeve you could remove if you wanted and stick it on the wall. You open it up and there's a video inside it, which actually has moving parts.
Yes.
Inside the video. I mean, it seems so archaic now. Almost medieval.
Nice.
I know. Nice link. And actually, funny enough, the third Evil Dead film, Army of Darkness, when it came out in the UK, it was titled The Medieval Dead because it was set in medieval times.
Yes.
So there's another incredible link for us.
Now, you've had an impressive career, and I would like to say in continuing to, obviously, an impressive career in journalism. And you've no doubt interviewed all sorts of interesting people. I was wondering, what has been your most challenging interview?
During my time as a rock journalist, an interview that stands out as both challenging and a really funny experience was interviewing a heavy metal band called Pantera.
Oh, you're familiar with them?
Yes.
One of their albums I played the hell out of during my teenage years.
Was that a vulgar display of power?
Oh my God, yes, it was.
Yes. Oh, what a gem.
It's so, so good. And my dad was so shocked when I had it on, would you believe, I had it on like, I can't even remember if it was a Discman or something that I was listening to it. And he said, oh, what are you listening to? And I gave him like the headphones and this look of horror on his face. And he said, this is very angry, Emma. And I was like, yes, yes, it is. I don't think he realised that, you know, the rage that was always there under the surface. But do carry on. I love that. You met them. Wow.
Yes. I interviewed them in Baton Rouge. We were in a beer garden behind some kind of pub. And at the time, I'd met the band once or twice before, but they didn't seem to remember like a lot of rock people. And at the time, they hated the magazine I was writing for because of some kind of imagined slight or some kind of bad review. And so I had quite a hard time with them. And at one point, one of them got me in a headlock in a kind of a playful fashion, but at the same time, in a kind of a warning signal fashion. And after quite a while of just getting nowhere with a few questions, I challenged them to play a game with me, whereby I wanted to prove that I actually liked the band because they were one of my favourite bands. And so I challenged them to hum a few of their songs. And I would try to identify what they were.
Wow.
And after saying that, I was a little bit afraid because I'd made a bit of potentially a rod for my own back. But they hummed three of their songs, and I'm happy to say I got them all right.
Oh, wow.
And after that, I think it broke the ice a little bit, and we could get on with it and get very drunk indeed. And I ended up doing a bonus interview when the others had left with the singer. So I earned twice the money I thought I was going to. So, you know, it's good to persevere sometimes.
And there's an alternative history out there somewhere where you ended that day with like a broken neck or something.
Yes, ferried away in an ambulance. That would have been quite the story as well, wouldn't it?
It would have been. So that was, wow, that's a really good story. So that was one of the most challenging ones. Do you have a favourite interview experience?
Well, funnily enough, that is both one of the most challenging and and literally one of my favourites. I suppose because it was a triumph over adversity. I really must stock up on interview stories.
It's terrible, isn't it? Whenever anyone says to me, what's your favourite book? I forget every single book I've ever read in my life.
Yes. I know. I think my favourite ever trip as a rock journalist, because I spent most of the 90s kind of flying around the place, really. This was back when record companies had some kind of budget to actually fly journalists and photographers around. And I think it was 1994, and me and a photographer went to Japan with the Manic Street Preachers.
Wow.
Which was as lovely as you'd expect. Back then, the Manics were controversial, sloganeering rock stars outwardly, but in person they were lovely, quietly spoken Welsh gentlemen.
Aww.
And at that point, Richie James was still in the band, and so it was lovely to get to know him a little bit. And Japan was fun. It was just, I mean, it is kind of the quintessential rock star destination, really, isn't it?
Just, yes.
You can just say any band name and add "in Japan" on the end. It just sounds great. That's a live album right there, isn't it?
Did you ever meet the Smashing Pumpkins?
You know, I never did.
Oh.
Are you a big fan of the Smashing Pumpkins?
I was a huge... When you were saying in the 90s and thinking about the 90s, they were one of my favourite bands.
Yeah, I mean, they were definitely... they definitely had their own unique identity, didn't they? And Billy Corgan was certainly a great songwriter.
Yeah, and they wrote one of my favourite all-time songs, which is Lily, which is the one that sounds really sweet, which sounds like a really lovely love song. And then you realise it's all in the mind of a stalker as he's being taken away by the police.
Enough, that was the last song they ever recorded.
And I love that song so much because it, even the music sounds really romantic and light and lovely. And it's like really, I think actually informed quite a lot of my writing in my later life. I suddenly realised where I like things to look lovely, but they're actually really awful. With your journalism background and the fact that in kind of journalism you have to have a narrative of sorts in an article, in longer articles, I was wondering if you approach writing your novels in the same way as you approach writing articles as a journalist.
That is an interesting question. I wonder how journalism prepared me for the heady world of fiction. I suppose in one sense, just in a practical sense, journalism definitely prepared me in terms of meeting deadlines.
Yes.
And respecting the mighty deadline, because I was working for Kerrang! Magazine back then, which was and still is a weekly rock magazine. At one point I was news editor, so for a whole year, so that was quite a hectic year. And yeah, so it definitely prepared me in terms of deadlines. And I think also maybe kind of writing news pieces definitely schools you in the important stuff to put up front in a news piece, you know, not just the headline, but the first line of the news piece, that kind of pyramid of information. Maybe some of that drips down into fiction when you're trying to think what the first line should be in terms of intriguing people and wanting them to read on, sinking those hooks in. And I guess in a directly practical sense, it's helped me with my novel, The Last Days of Jack Sparks, quite directly, because Jack Sparks is a journalist in the novel, and he's a music journalist at that.
Ah.
So write what you know.
Yes, that's exactly what I just thought.
Yeah, it definitely helps. I mean, I think, I don't know about you, Lady Newman, but I tend to enjoy writing most when I feel a sense of writing with confidence and authority. And I enjoy it least when I'm trying to find a character or a story. And so it's quite nice to have a linchpin in the sense that you know the character you're writing about, isn't it? It's just nice to be able to lean on that a bit.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I definitely agree with that. But I think that I'm writing my ninth novel now, and there are only so many things I can know well enough to think that I can write authoritatively.
Yes.
So it's kind of got to the point now where I think there are emotional landscapes that I can write about authoritatively, but I can't have every character have an element of something being directly related back to me, because I'm not that interesting and I won't have that
for a moment.
But you know, when you're trying to have a diverse range of professions and characters and you know, experiences, there comes a point when you kind of have to break away from things that you know directly. But that's really exciting. It's terrifying, but it is really exciting as well.
That's true. And actually, that reminds me of another aspect of journalism that I suppose helps with fiction writing, interviewing people in terms of research. It probably helps me quiz people when I'm trying to find out, for instance, in the Jack Sparks novel, there's a scene on a plane and I wanted to have it from the air stewardess's perspective. And so I know a guy who works for BA on the planes, and I quizzed him to within an inch of his life, and it just helps, really, doesn't it? Even if you only use just a flavour of what your research subjects have told you, it just adds that little bit of truth to the proceedings.
I totally agree, and I think that is always going to be the kind of the blessing and the curse of good research, that you're only ever going to show like 10%.
Yeah.
And that you should only show 10%, because you can sometimes see in a book where it's like the author has done a lot of research and they want you to know.
They
want you to appreciate it. And it's like,
let the info dump commence. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I'm not sure I needed to know every single detail here, but I think it does make you feel more grounded. And I think also that it stops you saying really stupid things as well.
Nothing stops me saying stupid things. Nothing on God's earth can stop that process.
I think the other thing that's really interesting about research as well is how it challenges assumptions that you didn't realise that you had. I remember ages ago coming across this article about what people have to wear in their role as air stewards and how little choice they have and how prescriptive the uniforms are. And there's just, we had been some baseline assumption throughout my entire life that the ladies in particular who work on these flights are all wearing their hair in this way and all that makeup because they want to. It's like, no one would ever do that if they wanted to.
They all just happen to fancy that particular configuration of clothing and hair.
Yeah.
What a happy coincidence, yeah.
Exactly. Well, I've never been much of a girly girl, so it was kind of a, oh, they're that kind of girly girl. Yeah. And that's just who they are. But of course it isn't. That was just some stupidity on my part. So I think that's always really exciting when you interview someone and you think, actually, no, I've just been a complete pillock about this most of my life, and now I know what it's really like. It's nice.
Yeah, it's just good to. I mean, there's another character in the book who's a combat magician, and I was lucky enough to know a fine gentleman who is a combat magician, or a retired combat magician, a gentleman called Cat Vincent, and so I quizzed him on the subject quite a lot, and I actually ended up putting quite a lot of stuff that he told me verbatim into the character's mouth.
Hang on. I need to pause a second. Combat magician, that just sounds like something awesome.
Oh, sorry,
from fiction.
Yes.
Were there a real ones?
Well, yes. I mean, people who profess to be or to have been combat magicians.
In what sense? They throw fireballs at people? It can't be.
No, nothing quite so sort of, what's the word? Nothing quite so dramatic or visual. But combat magicians tend to be people who are hired to go to a building that seems to be haunted, or if somebody thinks they've been cursed, then they might contact a combat magician who will carry out some kind of psychic battle with, you know, whatever forces may or may not be there. Cat Vincent, you know, he's very open-minded about it all, and he doesn't sit there and tell you that ghosts are definitely real, because he is very much an open-minded character. But it's just a fascinating topic, and it seemed to tie in very, very nicely to the book. It was also funny that the character in the book that I was using as research for is an Australian woman called Sherilyn Chastain. And so it was quite surreal for him to read the book and see his words coming out of an Australian woman's mouth.
Yeah, I bet that's a bit of a mind job, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit.
One last question for you, which I'd like you to approach with the same, you know, journalistic integrity that you have throughout your career. If you were cursed to only taste one flavour for the rest of your life, which one would it be?
Ooh, I'll probably go with the thing that first came to mind, but let me just have a think. That is a remarkable left field question. I think I'm going to have to go with the first thing that came to mind, which was quite simply cheese.
Cheese?
Yeah, the flavour of cheese.
Any particular type of cheese?
Not really. I think I'm just a big fan of cheese. I mean, I must be, because as soon as you asked the question, that's what came to mind. And I thought, no, surely it can't be cheese. surely there must be another flavour I'd prefer. But then I sat there for a while and thought, no, actually there isn't. So I think it would have to be cheese. And maybe it's a slightly crafty answer, because I'm kind of assuming that I'd have access to all the flavours of cheese within that bracket.
I'm a big fan of loopholes in magical curses, so I'd like to think so.
Yes. You know, one type of cheese I've been searching for a long time, and it just doesn't seem to exist anymore, is walnut cheese. A kind of hard cheese with walnuts embedded in it, bits of walnut.
Yeah, I've had that, but a long time ago.
Yeah, it just seems to be one of these things, along with for instance, VHS video cassettes, that has faded into non-existence. And I demand answers.
Oh, shit, we're getting old.
No, just sitting here babbling on about the past.
I think this is what we're supposed to do, though. I think we're actually following some kind of unwritten rule about when you hit a certain age, everything seems better. And I've resisted it for so long, but yeah, it's hard not to in current times. It's very hard not to.
Well, I think it's probably the fact we're sitting in medieval England as well. It kind of takes you back, doesn't it? Literally.
It does, yeah. Our environment does affect us.
We can blame medieval England for bringing this curmudgeonly side out of us.
We can blame medieval England for a lot of things which are wrong with current England.
Indeed we can. Yes.
So I was wondering, if you had to choose a theme tune for your life, what would it be and why? Because I'm going to ask those very special chickens over there to sing it for us.
Now, I must confess that I've chosen this partly to challenge the chickens a little bit. I think it's good to keep them on their toes or their chicken feet. And I've chosen this not because not so much because it sums up my life. It's the song Breaking the Law by Judas Priest, the popular metal band Judas Priest. And, you know, I'm not a fan of Breaking the Law, obviously, but it is pretty much my favorite heavy metal song. Perhaps they might tackle the sort of the first riff that comes in the song, which is kind of quite a bit more melodic. You know, I could have been harder on the chickens. I could have chosen a Napalm Death song. And that's very tempting. But
now I'm quite excited by this.
Yeah, I know. Have you ever had a heavy metal song?
No, I'm really thrilled. We've never had heavy metal. I think one of the heaviest songs we've had is O Fortuna by Orff, but that's not, you know, heavy in the same way.
I did think about the Ace of Spades, but
I love that song so much.
Oh, me too. But when I tried to imagine what the chickens would actually sing, I just couldn't really picture it. So, you know, I have been slightly considerate on their behalf.
Oh, no. Oh, I wish you'd chosen the Ace of Spades because that's one of my favourite songs.
Well,
really.
We could tweak my choice, the Ace of Spades, if you really want to be that cruel to your own
chickens. I can't bully you into choosing a different song just because it's my favourite. That just would not be right. So I'm going to ask the chickens to sing Breaking the Law by Judas Priest. Because we need more of this in our life. We need chickenized heavy metal more.
I never thought I'd see the day when chickens would croon Breaking the Law by Judas Priest.
Well, there you go. You can hear it now.
Oh, listen to that. That I never dreamt that they would do it that well.
They are pretty remarkable. I might just see if I can get them to do the Ace of Spades sometime, just for my own personal pleasure.
As a special bonus. Yes. Well, you know, what are chickens for if not to be forced to sing heavy metal songs?
Yeah, I would like to think more invited to sing.
Sorry, invited, coaxed.
Yes, encouraged rather than forced, but yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, the Ace of Spades is my favourite purely because of that Young Ones episode. Do you remember where they had Motorhead in singing?
How could I forget?
Oh, that was the best Young Ones episode ever.
Yeah, Bambi's a classic.
It really, really is a classic.
Isn't it weird that the way that the Young Ones had just a song stuck in the middle of it? And no one, I don't think any other show, any other sitcom has emulated that since.
No, and it just made total sense within the kind of the nonsense of that world. It was just wonderful.
It's completely random. Those Madness were in another of the episodes, weren't they?
Yeah, yes, they were. God, yeah, I'd forgotten about that. I used to love that show. And I used to love it more because I was really too young to watch it. And my stepdad used to tape it and we used to watch it without telling my mum. Hopefully my mum won't ever listen to this, but yeah. So when I used to love it, it was great. It seemed so subversive, and you watch it now and it's so tame.
Do you think so? I suppose so.
In some ways, I think the things that I found most subversive aren't, because it was through very young eyes.
Yeah.
But when you put it into historical context, actually some of it is quite gut-punchy.
Yeah, I guess the thing that really endures with the Young Ones, rather than any kind of controversy or extremity or rudeness, is the random nature of it. You know, the random nature of the Young Ones keeps it fresh, I think.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's wonderful.
Oh,
so, The Last Days of Jack Sparks has literally just come out, hasn't it?
Yes, indeed. Yes, the paperback has come out through Orbit Books, which is nice.
So if you had to describe it in one sentence or less, in the way that us authors are tortured into doing.
The lift pitch.
Yes. I want your lift pitch, please.
Yes, it's the Last Days of Jack Sparks is a supernatural thriller about an arrogant celebrity journalist who sets out to debunk the supernatural in his new book, then ends up dead.
Wow, that's really good. You're really good at that.
I've done it a couple of times before, you know.
Anyone would think you were a professional or something.
I know. And what fools they would be.
Well, let me just check the... Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty.
Oh, dear.
Oh, I'm sorry, but how about I wrap up some of these Brindons and put some of the sauce in a pot for you to take with you and enjoy back in the 21st century?
I have developed quite a taste for those little delights.
Yeah, so they're lovely, aren't they?
Oh, thank you. That would be a pleasure, Lady Newman.
Wonderful. Well, I'll just pack these up for you. And if you just go back out of the tent and follow Latimer, he'll lead you the right way out back to the time machine.
Oh, yes. I'm sure no harm will befall me on the way.
No, nothing could possibly go wrong.
No. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Now, take care now.
Good day to you.
Good day to you too, sir. Bye.
Bye.
This way, sir.
Ah, the jousting is starting up again. Wonderful. Is it me, Latimer? Or are those two knights actually charging at Jason rather than each other?
I believe so, ma'am. It may have something to do with the insulting message stuck to his back.
Oh gosh, that is very rude. There's no call to talk about someone's horse like that.
I don't believe it's referring to their actual horse, ma'am.
But it wasn't there when he arrived. Who stuck it on?
I have no idea, ma'am.
He's going to be crushed between them, or impaled.
Hopefully twice, ma'am.
Well, he's thrown down his phone. Is that an offering?
Perhaps it's a new model, and he wishes to leave it to his inheritors undamaged.
Hang on, is that the Springboard app? I thought that was a myth, or at least one of those silly names for some management application software.
No, ma'am. It turns a phone into an actual springboard. Guaranteed for one use.
Oh, I can't bear to look.
Oh, the horror.
Is it bad, Latimer?
The phone is completely ruined.
But what about Jason?
I'm afraid he remains unperforated.
You don't think he'll blame us for this, do you, Latimer?
Shall I pack up the tea things, ma'am? Just in case.
Good idea. While Latimer's clearing up, may I just take a minute to tell you that the fourth Split Worlds novel, A Little Knowledge, has been released? You really need to read this series in order, so it's best to start with Between Two Thorns if you haven't tried it. I'm so excited about it, I'm even willing to risk Latimer overhearing this.
Overhearing what, ma'am?
Nothing. Time to go. Find us a new location for the tea lair, Latimer. Somewhere a bit more fragrant.
Very good, ma'am.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.